Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to
Newsworthy. Let's get ready for new.
You do that every time, Jonathan. Every time. Go ahead, say it, Jonathan.
Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
At least you got it right this time, Jonathan. You've been studying up. I appreciate
that. I listened to all the podcasts.
Wow, I appreciate that. If you guys didn't figure it out, this is Jonathan Stormont, my good friend, all the way in from West Texas. Welcome to the show, Jonathan. So you do listen to all the show? All the shows?
Oh, yeah, man. I love your podcast, Luke. My wife and I were talking about the other day. We would listen to this if we weren't super good friends, because you do a really good job of asking questions and being prepared. I get the sense that if I was getting to sit down with some of these great writers and people that I really appreciate their work, I would ask the same kinds of questions you did, or wish I would have asked those questions. So yeah, I listen to every one of your podcasts, man.
Keep going. Tell me more about how awesome I am. Keep going with that. That was a really good train of thought you were on. You know, the weird thing about interviewing people is there's always the assumption that the person being interviewed is more interesting than the interviewer. So this might be a good chance for us to turn that around and just talk about me instead. I really liked where this was going.
For those of you listening, this has actually been scripted. just reading off the notes that Luke has emailed me about what we're supposed to say.
Exactly.
So here I'm supposed to say, yes, you are a very interesting person. And the people you interview are lucky to get to.
Funny thing is, I couldn't get Ian to read that off. I don't know why. Ian Cron was not going to say, Luke, you're so awesome.
Oh, he's got some integrity. I've had to sell my soul for you to peddle my book.
Yes, that's what it is. Well, you do have a new book out. You know, can I tell you something? I've botched the name of books multiple times on this podcast, and I've learned to write it down, and I forgot to write the title of this book down. It's How to Start a Riot. Isn't that the correct title?
That's it, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
you know, one of the things I like about you, Jonathan, is like when you're doing a series or not, and I'm sure it's for this book as well, but you really like try to figure out what it's like. Like you did a series about Christians going to Hollywood a while ago, right?
No, that was not the series. I went to Hollywood for the series to be an extra. The series
Extras. And yeah. So like you went out and figured out what it was like to be an extra on a TV show, right?
Yeah.
What show were you an extra on again?
The politically correct way of saying it is GCB. It was Good Christian Bells, is what it was.
Was that based off a book?
You know, I think it was. But you're just going to have to Google that for more information if you want.
So, okay, with your commitment to really embodying the stuff you're talking about, I would assume with a book entitled How to Start a Riot, you probably went and participated in some sort of riot, correct?
I have been involved in riots before unintentionally.
But really?
Like one time when my wife and I, when we were at Harding, we went to a soccer game of Thessalonica and Real Madrid. And
that's a long drive from Arkansas.
Yeah, well, it was a long drive from Puerto Rafty, where we were living. But we went with a group of people, and we got like the cheapest seats possible. And you know, I'm a SEC Razorback fan. I'm used to people getting worked up in frenzies. I've almost gotten in fist fights with people at football games, and I'm a pacifist. So I'm used to that kind of stuff, but I'd never seen anything like this. The people in our section started rioting. And by that, I meant they lit the stands on fire.
What?
Before the game even started. The guy who was sitting next to me at one point, I was like, man, this is crazy. And I looked over, and he's passed out with a heroin needle stuck in his arm. Wow. It was crazy.
I'm going to tell that story next time our friend Sean Palmer tries to speak to me about the awesomeness of soccer. That right there.
Oh, yeah.
You have to shoot up on heroin before a match to really enjoy it.
Or light the stands on fire.
Yes, either way. Okay, so you're used to riots, and so that's why you decided to write this book, because you were used to seeing people with heroin needles watching soccer matches.
Yeah, that's what I'm wanting to promote here. So yeah. Thanks for framing it that way.
So listen to Jonathan or read Jonathan's book and you'll learn about heroin.
Yes. Wait, what? No.
Isn't that what you said?
If that will make you buy the book, I suppose.
So how, okay, let's, before we get into really talking about the book, how is the process of talking about the book and getting the word out on this book? Because it's been out for 4 or 5 weeks now, or 2 months, something like that?
Yeah, I think technically it releases June 10th, but
it's not out yet?
Yeah, it's out. I think it's like staggered. They released it for the first time at Pepperdine at the end of April, and then Randy Harris, who you're going to interview, I think, soon.
Mm-hmm.
His book, we both had a book signing at the local Mardell's, and that was when it kind of released for Mardell's. And then I think it's going to be like in Lifeway and Family Christian and places nationwide starting in June. But it's available on Amazon. I'm not sure how all that works. I'll tell you this, man. You know, this is my first book to write. I like writing. But if you ever want to have a kind of humbling experience, you need to try to orchestrate something like a book signing.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, we had people show up who were supporting us. Part of it is, you know, the money from this book all goes to the Highland Church that I preach at, and specifically the kind of stuff we're trying to do with, like, starting water wells and microfinancing and supporting missionaries and working with homeless ministries in Abilene. And so people are, you know, trying to support that as well. But there is something about having a book signing that is really humbling. One is that, what do you do when you see people, when you make eye contact with people that you love, that love you, but they're not behind a book? They just like happen to accidentally be in the wrong place at the wrong time, and
they feel like they have to, and they just keep on walking around the store and they don't buy a book even though they made eye contact with you.
Yeah, like they just showed up to get like their wife a card, and all of a sudden they're like, oh hey, there's a friend, and then they realize what's happening, and awesome. They know that it. They get it signed, they got to pay for it. So they kind of slip out the back.
Has it been better doing book signings or the radio interviews that you've been doing?
I mean, they're very different. Radio interviews are kind of weird to me because it's Christian radio, and I have like a love-hate relationship with Christian radio. I think a lot of good things come out of it. And, it's weird for one thing because I'm sitting in my office like touring the nation, getting calls from like Toledo, Ohio, and Michigan, and all these places that I don't have any real context for, and they don't have really any context for me. One of the things you do really well, back to you,
yep,
reading the script.
Good subject here.
I've always got the impression you've read what you're going to ask about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I get the impression that happens about one third of the time with these interviews.
Well, you know, in all seriousness, I've had follow-up conversations after these interviews that I've done where I've had people say, you know, I really appreciate you being like a careful reader, or you really know the book, or you really know what's going on. And my first thought is to say, well, it's a book. I mean, it's not like it's a pop quiz or something. You know what the subject is. Just read the book beforehand. I don't understand how people don't do that. But I guess on radio, you're doing spots, you know, every day, and you're doing interviews with people. Maybe you don't have the time to do it, but it seems to me like it's a pretty easy solution to the problem. Just, you know, read the book.
Yeah. And we, like the people who promote it, Leafwood Publishers, they are the ones that set all this up, and they actually give them questions that say, if you ask this question, Jonathan will be able to answer it. and it'll actually be like appropriate for your radio station and stuff. And I'm surprised how often they don't read the book or ask those questions.
They don't even ask the questions that they're given beforehand?
No, and I guess they're thinking we know our context better than you. But they don't know me, and so like I think I've unintentionally gone against what they were hoping to do with their program, because what? They would ask questions and I would answer them.
Give me an example of that.
One of my first question, one of the first interviews, and I'm just going to keep this generic so I don't call anybody out, but one of the first places that I did an interview with, it was like this, it was early in the morning. I drove up to the office early to do this. And, you know, I'm thinking, okay, they've got a script. I've got a script. I'm going to talk about the, because I care about this book and what we wrote. So I have no problem talking about it. But the person didn't ask one of the questions. He asked something like how to start a riot. Why would anybody want to start a riot? Why would any Christian pastor want to write a book like that? And so I thought, okay, well, let's do this then. If we're going to, let's have an interesting conversation. And so I told him, you know, when I was a college minister in the Dallas-Fort Worth area for several years, and I noticed that there were two kinds of parents that came to me. One of them wanted to talk me into getting their kids more into church, and the other wanted to get me to talk their kids more out of church. And he was like, what do you mean? I said, well, the first group wants their kids, you know, involved in the programs and ministries of a local church. And the other group is worried about a mission trip that their kid is signed up for that's not very safe. And that's a buzzword in a lot of like Christian industry Bible Belt things. You know, safe and fun for the whole family. Or I told them, you know, their kids are picking like a major or a vocation that doesn't quite line up with what they had thought about the American dream. And the guy said something like, now we love America here. And sure, of course, Christians should be good citizens in whatever country that they're in. But part of the reason I wrote this book is because I wonder if they realize, these two groups of parents realize just what it is they're trying to do. The first group is trying to talk their kids into doing something that historically speaking has been really kind of risky and dangerous. And the second group, I don't think, knows just how soul numbing what they're trying to do to their kids would actually be. They want, in my experience, I think a lot of parents want their kids to have small doses of Christianity, but not the whole thing. And so part of what I wanted to do with this book, it's a book based on the book of Acts. I wanted to say, look, you know, this is kind of what we've signed up for. I think we lost that. I think we lost the ability to appreciate the revolutionary nature of our story.
Yeah. Let's go back to that soul numbing phrase that you just used earlier. You talked about what they're trying to do is very soul numbing, giving just little doses of Christianity. Talk to me a little bit more about how you think Christianity can be soul numbing in the way that we package it. Maybe as a parent, we want our kids to have this. How is that soul numbing for our kids, or maybe just for ourselves?
There was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago by Ross Duttat, I think is how he pronounces it. But it was on basically this, that Christianity is good for the world, but not in small doses. That what we really do is we inoculate ourselves. And so we create churches and cultures where everybody's fine. Sin is not something that is confessed and acknowledged. I think Ian Cron said on here, the greatest thing that American spirituality has contributed to the world is the 12-step program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was talking with an alcoholic yesterday and just telling how much I appreciate him being at Highland. He told me this, and I love it. I want him to tell the whole church this. He said, for Lent at Highland, we did this thing where we had people come up and write out, like, kind of naming sin in their life. He waited till everybody left and came up there and read them. And he said that was the most encouraging thing to him, because for the first time he realized, oh, we're all on the same page here.
Wow.
And, you know, I feel like that J.K. Chesterton said that the doctrine of original sin could be better explained as the doctrine of the equality of man. And I think that's right. I think it is the great leveling playing field. And one of the ways that we numb our souls is by not admitting kind of the honest nature of ourselves, not admitting like the idols that we lean into.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, for example, we are the most secure nation in the world, and we talk about security and we're more afraid than any nation in the history of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that's a symptom of a numbed soul.
Now, first of all, the Newsworthy with Norsworthy podcast loves America. Okay, so don't get offended by what he just said there. Okay, when I was reading your book, one of the things I thought about was you're obviously calling us to, and not you, but the Book of Acts calling us to start a riot, so to speak. And I was thinking one of the reasons that it's hard to start a riot is the riot has to be started in us. Like something has to happen inside of us that causes us to turn our life upside down. And if you're just getting small doses, and as you're talking about small doses, it reminds me of like how a vaccine works. Like you get a small dose of this illness, whatever the illness might be, and therefore your body learns to create antibodies and then it fights it off. And so it seems like that sort of small dose Christianity prevents us from ever having a riot start inside of us. And if it's not inside of us, then we can't start a riot outside of ourselves. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I very much agree. I think the language I've used before is that we're inoculated to it, which is that kind of vaccine language. And the part of the thing that I write about in this book, but I also talk about a lot, is the church that I grew up in. It helped me not to inoculate myself because I grew up in the Bible Belt.
Now, are you talking about the little 10-member church that you grew up in back in Arkansas?
Yes, that church was, I saw the gospel lived out in 100 ways. And so it is really hard for me to get cynical about the local church because of that church.
What are some ways that you saw the gospel lived out 100 ways? You tell about brother so-and-so who is very active in race relations and bringing reconciliation there. Before you move on, tell me some more examples about how you saw the gospel lived out in your home church.
You know, and we had our flaws, we had our problems, but the generational generosity of that church, they paid for me to go to college, basically.
Are you serious?
For my first semester. Yeah, Brother Foy, a school teacher, drove me to Harding, and I found out later he had taken out a loan for me to get to go.
Wow.
Because we were, you know, rural, poor. I was going to do construction work for as long as I could and you know, maybe preach at little churches around there.
You're not built for construction work. How is that going to work?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have had a job long, but that was the plan.
So obviously, that's very generous. I mean, that blows my mind. That's the kind of Christianity that everyone would love to experience themselves. So obviously, that prevents you from having cynicism because you had such a positive experience, right?
Yeah, but it's not just that. I mean, like when I think of church, I, you know, Ben Seibert, the executive minister, he's kind of my ministry partner. We do all things together at Highland, and he's started to say to other people to explain like why I care about certain things. Jonathan's kind of haunted by this little church. When I think of church, I think of that, and you know, like Brian, the Down syndrome boy, leading singing prayer communion. We had Simran, the Sikh.
Hold on. You got to tell the story about Brian's prayer. That's one of the most beautiful stories in the book. Go ahead. You got to tell us that story.
So Brian, he leads worship every Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. And basically what happens is he would stand up, pick the number, and Miss Ruby would, our brother Foy, would start it from the second or third row. And then we started having him like lead the closing prayer. And he would do the same thing every time because we'd go eat afterwards. Brian would thank God for the people at church that day. And then he would tell God where we were going to eat and what he was going to order every time. So it would go like, thank you, God, for Foy and Ruby and Jonathan. And I'm going to go to Taco Bell and I'm going to get a chalupa and a tostada. Amen. And so that was the church.
That's beautiful.
Then Brian started passing out communion, or he would help pass out communion. But at that church, if you were a dude, you were going to do something. It didn't matter. You know, Simran the Sikh had passed out communion. And one day we had a guest come in, and he was asked, would you, you know, wait on the table? So he stands up there and he's waiting on the table, and he doesn't know the rules, which is we don't have Brian pray for communion because we know what that prayer sounds like. And we didn't want like the Burger King menu read at the communion table. And so the guy prays for the bread, everything's great. And then at the time for the cup, he turns to Brian and he thinks like, okay, you know, if he's up here with me, so he's like, would you pray for the cup? And the whole, I mean, the church is just like, no. And Brian bows his head and prays, thank you, God, for this. I know it hurt you. Amen. And it was just this holy moment.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I can't. You know how you have those preaching stories that you kind of get numb to after a while because you've just told them so much? I still can't get over that. And that's what I think of when I think of church. And there's a lot of different forms that church takes. When Rick Ashley was on your podcast, one of the things you know, he's like one of my best friends and mentors. One of the things that he said that I appreciated the most was, don't be condescending to other forms of church.
Yeah.
Because church exists in a lot of different ways. I don't care what it looks like, but the same spirit that did that in that 10-person church I saw at the Hills Church when I worked at that mega church in Fort Worth, I see it at Highland. I see it in strip malls and cathedrals, and I believe God is alive and working in the local church, and I think that's why I wanted to write this book for her.
Yeah. Well, you obviously love the church, and you also are willing to push back against some of the ways that this church that you love so much might have kind of veered off course. And one of the things that you push back on a lot in the book is, you know, consumer Christianity. And you say one of the reasons that churches are not, you know, starting a riot, maybe metaphorically speaking, is because we're too busy fighting over dumb things, right?
Yeah.
Have you heard of, you know, the phrase shadow management? The idea that you deal with one thing over there so you don't have to deal with your real issue in front of you. And that was the idea that was coming to mind as I'm reading this line, that we're fighting over petty things instead of fighting for the big things of the kingdom of heaven. Like, you know, the church that fights over, okay, what does the daycare do in our church building? And instead of dealing with the bigger issues, which your church really need to be caring about, you deal with this small, tiny thing instead of dealing with the big, substantial kingdom issue. Why do you think we do that so much?
You know, I love this question, and I'd actually like to have a conversation about it that I don't have a real answer for. The pat answer is I think it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we've been kind of shaped more by Western consumerism than we have by the gospel.
Yeah.
Because the gospel is calling you to die.
Yeah.
And there's no marketing spin you can put on that.
Mm-mm.
You know, John Calvin's seminaries used to be called schools of death.
Wow.
I know, right?
You know
I like that.
You know who would love that? Richard Beck. He loves the death stuff. He would be really happy about that. Okay, so you don't hear that kind of language. It's not called a gathering of people who are committed to dying. That's not the language we use at churches. Is that where you're going with that?
Well, I think we use that language. I just think, like you said, I think we might be inoculated to it. Hmm. Here's the conversation I'd like to have with you about that, because I don't know where I land on this, but I've been talking with a few friends. You know, I believe the local church is the only institution that exists for the people who don't belong to her.
Yeah.
I think that's true. But, you know, like Andy Stanley's Deep and Wide, I read that and I got, you know, all riled up. And yeah, this is – have you read that, by the way?
I've read parts of it.
Okay. Yeah, it's good for, you know, the church leaders to read and think with new eyes. But one of the things he says at the beginning is, who is the church for? Is it for the church member people, or is it for the unchurched who are looking to know about God? And I like that question, so I took it to Jeff Childers to kind of – Jeff Childers goes to church with us. He's a
– church historian, yeah.
Friend of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Friend of the show.
And I asked him that question, who is the church for? And his answer was – God. It's like, oh, yeah, that's a...
yeah, of course. I was going to say God.
Right. And so then I realized, okay, that is the right answer. And then I realized the challenge that I have as kind of a minister is, so what? If the church is for God, then the primary way the church is for God is by making it for the people of God for the sake of the world. So it seems to me like what happens in Bible Belt Christianity, at least in churches, is that there's this bend internally, and that's when we start fighting over carpet and seats and programs and, you know, what you're not doing. That's when we start becoming really consumeristic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other option that it seems like I'm presented with is the word missional, mm-hmm. which is, you know, and we're all in with missional. At Highland, we want to spend more money outside than internally.
Yeah.
I think that's a good kind of baseline thing to do. But the problem I'm wrestling with is, what happens when the single mom becomes a member?
Yeah.
Is it still missional, or is now like, do we need to like, well, thanks for being here, and we're going to go help the people who don't belong here anymore? Or
mm-hmm.
is the way that we care for the world in the name of Jesus by making sure that in the church, those needs are met, but not in a... How do you do that without it
being
consumeristic?
Yeah, that's a tough issue. You know, I've been wrestling with that. I'm a church planner, and I don't like... Let's hope these people don't listen to this podcast, because I hate to talk about other people, you know, behind their back. But it's not behind their back. It's on the internet. So that's really in front of them, per se. But so... I like to go to the gym, work out, and you know, there's a, you know, half dozen or so people from my gym that have been a part of my church. I've been, you know, joined, got plugged in, whatever. And you know, there's a part of me that thinks, okay, well, we've got these new families here, so I need to move on and try to connect with new people. But that would mean I don't continue to put the time and the effort into maintaining these relationships that I already have with these people who are now a part of our church. And so it's almost like, well, I got him in the door. Well, now I need to move on and get new people. And that just sounds, it makes me feel dirty and filthy, because it feels like I'm just selling them a product. And as soon as I sell them, get them in the door, now the single, proverbially speaking, the single mom is a part of our church, and therefore she's already here, so I need to move on to someone else. And that doesn't seem right at all.
Yeah. That's what I'm wrestling with, because, I mean, I think ideally we disciple those people to care about the single moms that are in their neighborhoods and help them see why we were reaching out in the first place. But It feels like it's a real either or thing that it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I don't know how to.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel there's a part of me that's wired to think, yeah, you're going to connect with someone, you're going to, you know, be missional, bring the gospel to them, and then bring them into the Christian community. And once you get them in, then you got your job done, you feel good, and everyone rewards you for being evangelistic. But then all of a sudden you just move on, and that turns that relationship into something that's really shallow and kind of cheap if you've sold the product and therefore you don't want to maintain the relationship at the level of interest that you put in beforehand. And I think that's like the telling factor is, how do you treat people once they're already in or once they've already decided that they don't want to be a part of your community? If you treat them different on either end of those spectrum, then your relationship and your love, it's not genuine. It's ultimately just a sales pitch.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but then also there's this like high bar of what it means to be a part of the community, right? I mean, like the neo-monastic movement, they're doing this thing, the vow of stability, because they realize we move so much, we're so individualistic. What other group outside of the church is going to be able to say, no, this story, because the story doesn't revolve around you, then the church doesn't revolve around you. And the question isn't, what do you get out of it? It really is, okay, so now that God has drawn you into this community, how do you serve? How do you serve the other? How do you serve people that you disagree with? And I mean, I wrestle with this all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. Because it ultimately goes back to your picture of who is God. And you know, that shapes everything that you do. And one of the things you touch on in the book is this moralistic therapeutic deism, which is a way of understanding God, that God is this, you know, part judge, part butler, part therapist, and that, you know, God is far and distant from your day-to-day reality, but every now and then God, he's going to reach in, he's going to fix your problem, he's going to answer the prayer, get you the job, get someone healthy. And that really ultimately turns God into this deity that exists to meet your needs and make you feel good about yourself. And that shapes how you understand church and how you understand your relationships with other people. And so going back to your idea of, you know, how to start to write, don't you think that view of God really distorts what church is supposed to be?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I think it goes back to our ideas of sin and that alcoholic I talked to yesterday. You know, the ancient world would, I think they have some things they could teach us, which is, you know, we say things like, God, we just want you to show up here. Well, every time in the Bible God shows up, people like wet their britches. You know, they're terrified. Mm-hmm. They want it to stop.
Yes.
Even in the New York Times, like a couple of weeks ago, there was an atheist who was writing about this like mystical experience of God that she hated.
Really?
You know, she wasn't looking for it. Yeah, like the Catholic mystic. She wasn't looking for an experience of God. She said she felt like her body was on fire. And wow. I mean, it was a really interesting article, but ultimately, I think when I read that, I was like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah,
that sounds a lot closer to the kind of what happened in the scriptures when God showed up than, you know, the kind of, and then my heart was a little warm, and not to diminish anybody's experience, but there is a sense in which God can eat your face off.
Yeah. You got me in that last sentence. I don't know how to follow that up. But what I was going to say before that face eating, you have a lot of vulgar metaphors, man. Like, I read one metaphor you said in the book, speaking of eating your face off, is that you referred to, like, the scene from Genesis where Adam's picking the animals and going to name them. You said it's a mixture of Animal Planet and The Bachelor, which that's pretty revolting as well. So, yeah, you got a lot of those.
Well, that's a weird story, right? Because it's like he's looking for a suitable partner. And I mean, it's a really funny picture to me, because he, you know, he's looking at the hippopotamus being like, no,
it's not going to work.
Just no, it's not. Seriously.
Yeah.
Like,
so you compared that to The Bachelor. That's really gross.
Yeah.
I wonder where he came up with that idea. I was going to say something earlier. Going back to when God shows up. In our typical language about when God shows up, it's amazing that it's always in a song right at the key change. Like, the key changes, and that's when everyone raises their hand, and that's when God shows up. And, like, this God who starts riots doesn't show up and doesn't do that kind of stuff. He it's more terrifying kind of experience.
Yeah. And you know, we just have gone through a worship transition at Highland where we talked a lot about worship and that kind of stuff. And one of the challenges I think the modern evangelical world has is we don't need to be like the prophets of Baal. You know what I mean? Like, the reason that they banged on drums all day long and cut themselves and screamed is because if they didn't, there's nobody who's going to make any noise. And, you know, wow. I think Christians believe God is alive and we're not the only one in this relationship. And so there is a sense in which anything is possible and we don't need to manufacture this.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about this a little bit more. So the gods you're referring to, the showdown with, was it Elijah at the Mount Carmel? Is it Elijah or Elisha? Which one is it?
Yeah, I think it's.
You don't know. It's one of them. Anyway, and so they're all cutting themselves. They're dancing around, and your comparison is that we don't need to be like that because we don't need to think that God isn't going to show up. I mean, because that's ultimately the fear is that you make a big production of God and you're going to trust Him, but maybe God's going to be silent. And maybe God's not going to be there. Do you think that's partly our fear and lack of comfortability with, like, silence and God's sometimes absence? Is that what that is, you think?
You know, I think that is a lot of it. I think we're, generally speaking, a lot of us are worried that underneath it all, we might be the only ones in this relationship. But the flip side of that is when I go to certain churches, when I go to African American churches or Latin American churches, they're making a lot of noise, and it's not because they're worried that God isn't really there. And, you know, there is a certain sense of celebration that happens, and I don't want to be the older brother sitting outside the party upset at the music and dancing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I just want to make sure that that's not the reason that we're having the music and dancing. Like, it's great to celebrate. This is a really good story. But I think it's important to address every now and then, like, hey, if we just had a service where we just showed up and waited on God, we think that He's alive and active, and He doesn't need us to program everything down to the minute. I think He's fine with Spirit-led preparation, but, you know, as long as that part is not there, as long as we're not worried that we're the only ones making the noise, then I think I don't want to be condescending to all the different ways that we worship and celebrate and honor God.
Yeah, I hear that. I do think, though, I mean, we get uncomfortable. I get uncomfortable if there's a transition that takes too long, or, you know, there's, you don't have the keys filling the sound, or the guitar is not strumming to, you know, make the transition prayer to get the next person on the stage smooth and efficient. And when there is that silence and there is that quiet, you know, we're not naturally comfortable with that. It's hard to be still. And I think on a bigger level, sometimes when you pray, that's one of the scariest things about prayer is that you pray and there's a lot of quiet from the other end of the phone, and the, you know, mm-hmm. you don't have that audible voice from God, and it's hard to continue to talk and to listen to someone that you don't always hear from.
Yeah. I mean, I would think that, I mean, there are people who I trust and respect as spiritual mentors to me who hear from God much more regularly than I do. I've heard from God several times in my life, but not on a regular, consistent basis. But you know, I'm kind of a mutt as far as I had this 10-person church I grew up in, and then I worked for 8 years at this 5,000-person church. And I saw some really beautiful things unplanned at both and planned at both. And, you know, I think a lot of stuff that at the Hills, that's the 5,000-member church, I think a lot of times God moved. He did it starting in Rick Atchley's office through, you know, prayer and kind of a spirit of discernment, and, you know, kind of using Rick's personality of planning and preparation. And then at the other end is Brother Foy, who would often, halfway through church, turn around and say, "Brother Jonathan will bring the word today."
Seriously?
And oh yeah. Oh, the worst. He did this probably 4 or 5 times. He would take me and another one of the young people at church to different churches to hear him guest speak. We probably went with him 25 times. And about 4 or 5 times, right before it was time for him to get up, he introduced me as the preacher. And so that only happened once where I didn't have anything. And then it was always on the way home. He would just say something like, "Be prepared in season and out of season to, you know," and
that would be the last time I would go on a trip with him. That would be the end of it. I don't think I'd go back.
But then you wouldn't get your college paid for.
That is a very good point. And we definitely want your college paid for. So we're glad about that. When you were talking about the silence, I think, you know, part of being comfortable with, you know, dealing with that silence is this vulnerability that you put yourself out there knowing that sometimes God's quiet and you don't want God to be quiet, but you put yourself out and it's this vulnerability. And you have this line from a guy named Andrew Wells in your book, and you say, "I think that there is a certain vulnerability, a fragility at the heart of Christianity. You might say that this is the vulnerability of the cross." Okay, so here's your last question. We're going to get you out on this one. What does it mean to live out that vulnerability of the cross or the fragility of Christianity in our day and age? What does that look like for us?
Man, I love that question, and I think it fits in right with what we were just saying, because the book of Acts, people hear from God all the time, and then they don't hear from God. You know, the Paul's missionary journeys, he's like, okay, I'll go here. No, that's Bithynia's off limits. Or, you know, he makes mistakes in the book of Acts. They have this Jerusalem council where they basically are having to wrestle with the implications of believing Jesus is Lord. And they throw out like 613 commands. They make 4. And there's a real spirit of humility there, because they just say, okay, it seems good to the Holy Spirit and us. And I love how kind of open-ended and generous they are, and how humble they are. I mean, there's no hubris in the book of Acts about, well, I got a word from the Lord. No. Even though they did. They got a word from the Lord, but there's this sense of like, we could have gotten that wrong. And I think that's the vulnerability. It is, we're human. And so when God speaks, and I do believe God speaks, there is a gap between what God says and what we hear. And that's because we're not God.
Yeah.
And so I like the way that the Holy Spirit moves and the believers receive it in the book of Acts.
Yeah, that's good. Well, there's some good stuff in that book, man. I hope people get a chance to go check it out, go listen to it. I guess there's not an audio copy of it out yet, is there? Then I should have said.
You can hear my voice if you're. Yeah. Would you like me to read a book?
I would like you to read me the book every night before I go to bed. Just read me a section of it so I can go to sleep with happy thoughts. And also read your stuff, your blog. You're on McKnight's blog as well. Does he even know? I don't think he knows your name. Because he just introduces you as a young pastor's response, a young pastor's take on this, a young pastor's. Does he know your name yet? I don't think he does.
Yeah, I think I'm okay with being a generic young pastor, there right for him.
How long till you're like a middle-aged pastor's response? When do you think that's going to happen?
I don't know. I think you had Wade on last.
He's middle-aged.
He is I think, middle-aged. Yeah, he's the target. It'll just keep moving.
Well, one day that could be you. Anyway.
As long as I'm not his age.
Ever. Anyway, hey, thanks for your time, Jonathan. Good stuff. Check out his book on Amazon.com, among other places that you can get it. Thanks again, Jonathan. See you, man.
Hey, good to be with you, man.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.